This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Reverend Slack grew up in a big family in rural Georgia. As a kid, he was dressed in little girls' clothes, but in the imaginary worlds he was creating, he was a man with a wife or a girlfriend, and often used the name he uses today, Michael. In college, Michael was living as a queer woman, and during that time he had a revelation that surprised his friends and himself. He had a sudden burning desire to be part of a church, and that began his quest for spirituality. He joined a gospel choir, and soon his journey took him all the way to seminary. During that education, he also discovered his true gender identity. Today, Michael Slack is co-director of the Freedom Center for Social Justice. That's an organization involved in civil rights and social justice efforts nationwide. He also recently embarked on a project to build an inclusive spiritual community in Durham, North Carolina. And we'll hear all about that and much, much more when we meet Michael Slack. Michael, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Take us back to those days in rural Georgia growing up in your family. Tell us about your earliest memories.
Oh, my goodness. My earliest memories involved really just being with my really big family. My mother has 11 brothers and sisters. My grandmother, who was their mother, is just a remarkable person. And, you know, whenever we could, we spent time with them. And also, I spent a lot of time at home. I was a homebody then. I still am now, even though I end up traveling quite a bit in work and ministry. But much of my time was spent listening to music. My dad had one of those old consoles that had the record players in them and the 8-tracks, you know, those.
And with, it had the, a, with the kind of the wooden legs
and then the little
metal feet.
Oh, yeah, with the big speakers and everything.
Okay.
And I would sit, like my biggest memories are sitting in front of that thing for hours and hours and hours.
Listening to music. Yeah, and you had two sisters, so this big extended family, all living close to you.
Right.
Two sisters.
All live in the metro Atlanta area, and I had two younger sisters.
Yeah.
I was an only child for 6 years, and my sister Megan was born, and then 2 years later, my sister Monica was born. And, yeah, it was just the three of us, my mom and dad, living in rural Georgia, you know.
Your grandmother had an important influence on you. Tell us about her.
She was a deeply faithful person. You know, she didn't talk about church much, but she talked about her faith quite a bit. And she would say, there's one thing that she often said that has stuck with me. She would say, you know, the best way to love God is to love yourself, to love the people around you, and love the earth. That's it. Like, that's all she would say. I mean, she said a lot of other things, but related to faith and spirituality, that was it for her.
Yeah.
And that showed up in all kinds of ways, right? Like, she cooked a million pies on Mother's Sunday, and, you know, she was at church 3 or 4 times a week. But there was something about that that stuck with me. And she was such a beautiful person and loved us so hard. I saw her 2 or 3 times a year, honestly. She lived two, three hours away from us in Oglethorpe, Georgia, Macon County. But even though I only saw her a few times a year, I had a deep, deep love for her.
That stuck with you.
It really, really did. It really did. And there was something really beautiful over the course of my life. You know, when she died, like the day she died, actually, I saw her in the hospital, and I got to read Ecclesiastes to her the day she died. And I look back on that moment. I'm like, she has no idea. You know, and I got to tell her in that moment. I hope she heard me.
Is that the, forgive me for if I got this wrong, is that the turn
mm-hmm.
passage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I read that passage to her and prayed over her. And I was deeply involved in ministry at that point. But I got to say to her that day, you had such a deep impact on me just from those simple words. It was pretty special.
Well, turning those simple words into the deep spirituality that is implied in them, that there is a spark of the divine in everything in creation.
Everything.
Coming to the full understanding of that is the journey, and we're going to talk about that. But you weren't quite there yet, because her church was a charismatic sort of an experience, right?
Yeah, just a little bit. It was a primitive Baptist church, and you know, I was there a couple of times a year when I was a very small child, so I didn't understand it, or I wasn't very clear about what folks were doing, you know.
I mean, this is a lot of the spirit taking over.
Oh, yeah. A lot of spirit taking over. Folks were getting laid out in the spirit, a lot of music, a lot of dancing, a lot of singing, a lot of reverence, deep, deep reverence for a God that had delivered all of these folks, right? And so, you know, I couldn't argue with that. I didn't understand it as a kid, but I knew that it mattered to her, and so it mattered to me.
You also grew up in a family with albinism that was part of the family, your mother.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So tell us about that and whether or not and how that shaped your sense of color and colorism.
You know, it was interesting. We were always very clear about who we were, right? But I remember growing up, there were a number of kids, especially in elementary school and middle school, who would fight with me. You know, it's like, well, your mom's white. Like, no, actually, she's not. She's albino. No, I think she's white. and it goes to show how little we know and understand about race and about the color of people's skin and what that looks like and means and how we talk about those things. We don't talk about these things. We don't talk about how to talk about all of this and how to approach issues of race. And so, you know, I was always deeply aware that we were a black family growing up in the South. You know, it probably wasn't until my teen years that I realized, oh, okay, there are things that I am not going to have access to because I'm a black kid. And that was hard. But, you know, I had a family who was deeply supportive and loving. And
was that the first time you really, by the time you were teens, I mean, had that occurred to you or been obvious to you earlier than that?
It was a little early. I was probably maybe 11 or 12 when that really hit home for me. And I think it was because my family was very protective. Hmm. You know, we spent time with each other. You know, we weren't really allowed to go hang out at other people's houses and that sort of thing. And I know why. Looking back at the time when I was a kid, I was upset about that. Like, what do you mean I can't go to such and such's, so and so's, you know, sleepover? What's that about?
Right.
Like, I didn't get that when I was 5 or 6 or 10. But looking back, I know they were being protective.
But, you know, the other questions that are raised by this, you know, these issues of people coming to you telling you based on your mother's appearance what race she is, and then you having to tell them, well, here's who she is based on her subjective experience. I mean, that gets to also very serious gender questions, the subjective sense of knowing who you are.
That's right.
Over and against the objective observation of others.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
When did you are a transgender man. Mm-hmm. You were raised as a girl.
Yep.
When did you tell us about your relationship with your gender growing up?
My relationship with my gender was deeply personal. And from the time I was very, very small, I knew that it had to be, right? Mm. I knew that there were perceptions of who I was. You know, I was assigned a gender at birth based on, you know, how I looked when I came out of the womb. And folks, of course, make all kinds of assumptions based on that. I used to have little dreamings and visions of myself as a little boy growing up.
How old were you when you started to have those visions of yourself?
It was probably 5 or 6, mm-hmm. From what I can recall.
Yeah.
And, you know, I imagined growing up into the man I was supposed to be. And, you know, I would name myself Michael or Brandon or whatever, and I would have a girlfriend, I would have a career doing all kinds of things. Like, these were my imaginings. And I knew, like, as long as I could hold that for myself, then I was going to be okay. It was just really interesting. I managed to convince myself that if I could hold on to my own truth, it was okay if other people had another idea.
Oh, that's just so I was going to ask you, maybe that was the answer, but what do you make of the fact that your parents are dressing you as a girl and addressing you as a girl? How did you reconcile that, or did you think you had to?
I didn't think I had to. It was interesting. I think by the time I was right before my teen years, probably from 10 to 12 or 13, I came to the conclusion that I'm okay with who I am. It's probably not going to be okay for other people. And that's really their problem. And as long as I can manage this on my own, I'll be okay. And that's what I did. It, you know, ultimately, I don't think it was the best thing for me. I held in a lot, right? By the time I got a job when I was 14, 15 years old, I worked at Belk Department Store. I don't even know if there are Belk Department Stores around.
A couple of them left,
You know, I would start to buy my own clothes. And so I started to make some shifts as I got into high school and college in terms of what I would buy for myself. But that was how I was expressive in my gender. I would wear specific things, which troubled my parents. They're like, right. Why'd you buy that? I like it. It feels good.
Then eventually you realize you can't honestly keep this to yourself, but certainly that's a fair fantasy to harbor as a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Oh, yeah.
And also you talked about listening to music. Music became important to you in high school as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I was in band in middle school and part of high school, which was amazing. I was a woodwind. I think I got my first lesson in what it means to be affirmed in who you are. I had a band director. Her name was Arlene Woods. She was a force to be reckoned with. but she loved me and cared about me deeply and really cherished and held my gifts in a way that nobody else had before. And so I felt really affirmed in my musical ability and skill and she's just a deeply caring person.
We will talk about how you took that affirmation forward in your journey to become the Reverend Michael Slack, who is now co-director of the nonprofit, the Freedom Center for Social Justice, also a minister. We'll talk about his many projects and find out more about his activism and mission to protect the rights of LGBTQ youth. We'll talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. The Reverend Michael Slack is the co-director of the Freedom Center for Social Justice. He's my guest. He's also a trans man, and during his personal journey to explore gender and identity, he also helps in the fight for the rights of other members of the LGBTQ community. And we're just starting that voyage for you. We talked about taking up the clarinet in high school and being affirmed for outside of your family, you thought, for the very first time. But at that point, you weren't out, so it wasn't, though, you were affirmed in that, but something somebody noticed something in you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, that took some time, but it was really meaningful to have someone say to me, you know, I believe in who you are. And it really matters that you honor the gifts that you have and that you be the person you're meant to be in the world. Like I held on to that. And I think it's helped me.
Well, tell us about going to school. Now, you went to Oxford College at Emory University, sister school at Emory, right?
Yep,
so tell us about that and kind of what were your aspirations going to college?
I wasn't quite sure when I started college. My primary goal was to get out of the house. I wanted to get out of the house, and I wanted to be around who I thought might be like-minded people. I presume that being in college would be an eye-opening experience for me. Like I said, my family was very insular. You know, we hung out with each other, and so this was a chance for me to get to know people. I'm a people person, generally speaking, which shocks my family to no end. You know, like, you want to go where? You want to talk to who? Like, how many people are going to be at your kid's birthday party? We're not the only ones who are going to be there. No. People coming from all over.
They're going to be people you don't know.
Yeah, people you don't know who are going to be there. So this is who I have always been. And so I got to really be that person in college. I was an RA. So I got that was my first opportunity really to support people in a way that they needed. And not in a way that I wanted to support people. So that was the first time I really got to do that. And it felt really special. And I held it in high regard, being able to do that.
And at first you thought maybe you studied economics and math.
Mm-hmm.
And had ideas about becoming an international banker.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I have no idea where that came from.
You meet a lot of people in that business.
You meet a lot of people in that business. I got to work at a bank once, which was fun. But, you know, I was good at math, and I appreciated the economics studies. These were things that I had fun doing. Yeah. So I thought, sure, I should major in something that I have fun doing. So I did.
Along the way, you met a teacher named Frank Maddox.
Yes. Yeah, Frank was my economics professor at Oxford. Brilliant, beautiful human being. And he saw something. He knew that something was going on with me that I had not named. And he was good enough to walk up to me after class one day and he said, you know what? I have a feeling that you might be going through something. If you ever need to talk to me, know that you can do that. I had never said two words to him. Hmm. I was in his class, but we didn't really know each other. And I thought, okay, maybe I should take him up on it. So maybe a few weeks later, I sat down and had coffee with Frank and told him that I thought I was queer. And turns out, you know, he was in the life as well and was just beautiful to me. He really supported me. And so who knows? I mean, would I have gotten an economics degree if he hadn't come up to me and said that? Maybe not. Mm-hmm. Like, there was something about being supported that I think made the journey a lot smoother for me.
And this is a theme that keeps coming up, I think, being recognized for who you are. Mm-hmm. You are acting and living as a straight woman at the time, right?
Yes,
were you?
At the time.
So you're presenting, and as far as you're concerned, the act is going over.
As far as I thought, mm-hmm. until Frank tapped
and
me
Frank
on the shoulder.
Frank says, wait a minute,
wait a
I'm
second.
Seeing something else.
What are you doing?
Yeah. Did you resist at all? I mean, because again, you can have a couple of responses, and the one you talked about was touching and beautiful. He recognized something in me, and I opened to that, and mm-hmm. it felt good and affirming. But I can also imagine a moment of resistance. What are you talking about? That's not me. Is that any part of it or not?
You know, it wasn't. Yeah. I walked away from that conversation. I didn't say anything to him. I just said thank you. Mm-hmm. And sat with that very brief conversation, thought, you know what? He's right. Mm-hmm. And if he's willing to be supportive, then maybe I need to step out a little bit and just be a little more of myself than I have been.
And so what did you do?
I met up with him again, and ultimately we talked to him. I told him about myself and about my life and what I was struggling with. And he said, you know, just live your life one day at a time. You know, you have friends here. You have support here. You'll be fine. And I believed him. And he was right.
And then you came out to your friends?
Came out to my friends.
Tell us about that.
that, you know, many of my friends were queer already. And they were like, yeah, we know. Glad you figured it out.
Have you noticed your circle of friends?
You noticed who you hang around. And, you know, they threw me a little coming out party, which was really special. They, you know, had cake and snacks and drinks and things. And it, you know, finally it was like, okay, here I am. Like, I get to be me. And it felt good. It felt really good.
What did you expect? I mean, when you, because you wrote a letter, didn't you?
No, that was later.
That was later?
That was later, yeah.
What did you expect, though? I mean, again, you're uncertain. You can look back now, and they threw a party, and that felt pretty good. But what were you expecting before you knew how they'd respond?
I was expecting people to run away. You know, I wasn't expecting not to have friends, right? Because I had queer friends in college. Before I was ever able to say anything about myself. I think that the place where I was most concerned about was with family.
Yeah.
I didn't know how that would go, and I assumed it would be hard, and it was. It was a struggle.
Well, first tell us about coming out to your sisters.
Oh, yeah. I was in a car driving my sister probably to school, is my guess. I don't know where we were going. I remember I was in a car with them, and I was like, I thought you should know that I'm a lesbian. And I, you know, I'm like, I'm telling my 12 and 10-year-old sisters. But we had a good relationship, and I knew that they would react and respond well, and I needed somebody in my family to react and respond well. And so I told them first.
And
they were fantastic. One of my older sisters was like, cool. Do you have a girlfriend? Like, really? Like, they were pretty spectacular.
Great.
And they have been my whole life. They're great people.
What about when you told your parents?
That was harder. That was harder. Mm. As I anticipated it would be, right? Like, I know that they wanted the best for me. And they were probably also really scared for me. You know, looking back, they really struggled. Like, maybe this is a phase, like all the things that parents say. Maybe this is a phase, maybe you're not sure, maybe you're not hanging out with the right folks, like all these things. And ultimately, you know, I spent many, many years not really being able to talk about the fullness of my life. They loved me. I knew that. I also knew that they were worried for my safety. They were worried about all the things that, good parents worry about, honestly. It took me a few years to get there to understand.
Did they address those? Because I can put myself in that position, try to be open-minded, but I can also think about my children. You're up against a lot. You know, African-American. Now you're telling me you're a gay woman. You know, what are you doing to yourself?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, you know, at the time I thought, well, they just don't understand me and they just, they're just not going to and they don't want to. But really, they wanted me to be all right in the world. And they thought, well, this is three strikes. You have three strikes against you. This is going to be awful. So we struggled. But, you know, it just, it took time.
What about school now? Again, aspirations to be an international banker, all of these changes now in your personal life, did it change where you wanted to be professionally?
Ultimately, I think it did. Although I may have gotten there anyway, you know. I had started doing some, offering some support for LGBT, mostly lesbian and gay students at, on Emory's campus. A friend of mine and I co-founded a new group on campus called Global.
What was that?
It's Gay, Lesbian, or Bisexual and Allies League. Well, I don't know if globals exist anymore, but there were some back then. And so we started this group. We did speakers bureaus. We talked to faculty and students about what it was like to be gay in the South and in and at Emory. I worked at the – Emory actually had an office of LGBT life back then.
And when was this? What
this was in the 90s. I was in, I was in college from 92 to 96.
Okay.
So – so yes, we did a bunch of different things, did events, you know, coming out day, national coming out day events, those kinds of things. And I think in the process of doing all of that, I realized, you know what, there's so much more that our folks need and should have, are hoping for, but don't have access to in this country and in the world. And so ultimately I realized I wanted to do more advocacy on behalf of LGBT folks.
Which sent you to law school.
Which sent me to law school. I wanted to work on behalf of LGBT youth, and I got to do that, which is pretty incredible. And yeah, it was a remarkable journey. I worked for Lambda for a semester, got to work on some youth in schools cases, which is really good work to do.
You decided to go to the City University of New York, right? So now you're moving north. You're going to New York City.
Yep.
Tell us about that decision.
Oh, that decision was easy.
Yeah.
I had wanted to go to college out of state, and you know, my folks struggled with me being away. I'll never forget it. I moved into my dorm room the first day of college. I called my mother. I said, "So, you have 4 years." She's like, "4 years to do what?" "To prepare for my departure." I am leaving the state of Georgia when I graduate from college, and that's just going to have to be okay. So you have 4 years to prepare yourself. And she's like, "Okay, fine, whatever."
So you knew.
Sure enough, I knew. Yeah. And I knew I wanted to be in New York, right? Yeah. For me, that was like the queer Mecca, right? Like, there are going to be rainbow flags everywhere, and I'm going to be able to be myself on the street wherever I am, and it's going to be great. And it was pretty stellar. I moved to New York in 96. I was 22 years old. I went to CUNY law school in Queens. And it was interesting. That was the first time in my educational life that I was surrounded by people of color. Like, there was a majority of people of color at CUNY Law School. And most of us were invested in public interest law, right? Like, we were all there to help make the world a better place in one way or another. And so the energy was high all the time. People were doing remarkable things. And I showed up talking about LGBT civil rights, and people were like, "Yeah, where do you want to do that?" I was like, "Yes!
Come to the right place.
I'm in the right place."
So your being a Southerner then didn't make you feel more like it now. You felt more at home.
I was at home.
Wow. Yeah.
I called New York home within a year of being there. I was there for 11 and a half years.
You worked for the Urban Justice League in New York City, and you also worked with the Gay and Lesbian Youth Center, and you worked with some kids at the Harvey Milk School. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah. It's actually called the Urban Justice Center.
Mm-hmm.
And within that that nonprofit, there were a number of different projects, and the Lesbian and Gay Youth Project was one of them. And so, you know, it's usually a big deal if you're a law student to work at specific places your first and second summer. Mm-hmm. So I worked at the Lesbian and Gay Youth Project my first summer, and it was there that I got to do a lot of work with LGBT youth who were on public welfare, like kids who were in foster care. I got to do some advocacy for. And part of my work was volunteering at the Harvey Milk School, which is a school in New York City for LGBT students. I mean, folks knew very, very early on that clearly these kids are not getting what they need in terms of education because they're being bullied. And so they're not able to take advantage of what schools can offer. So Harvey Milk School opened, which was really beautiful. And I got to go and just support these kids, you know, listen to them talk about what their family life was like and support them in their work.
And what was that like for you? Because, again, the idea that everybody's here, we all know why we're here, that could be at least a much more supportive environment.
Yeah. It was an incredibly supportive environment. Yeah. And you know, it was just another reminder to me that remarkable things happen when people get affirmed in who they are. Mm-hmm. You know?
You were living as a queer woman at the time. Were you mm-hmm. comfortable with that identity, or were there questions that you were beginning to have?
You know, I felt okay calling myself queer, because I still do. Mm-hmm. I struggled with lesbian identity, mainly because it just didn't quite resonate. I was like, something's not quite right about that, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how everyone sort of sees me. It kind of makes sense, so we'll go with it.
Tell us about your experience, because you've met a transgender person, as far as you knew, for the first time, and mm-hmm. that was an experience for mm-hmm. you. Tell us about it.
In law school, I met this person, Kit, I believe their name was, and the second I saw Kit and was able to listen to Kit talk about their life, I knew immediately. I was like, okay, this thing that has been kind of resonating and sitting inside of me someplace that I have absolutely no words for, like, suddenly I can see that in front of me. I can see this person and see that experience and know, okay, that's right. And so then I started doing research. It's like, okay, now that I've heard the word trans before, now that I've heard the word transgender, and someone who used pronouns that I wasn't anticipating, Kit used they, them pronouns, actually, before I'd ever heard anybody else do that. I went to a Barnes & Noble one day, I'll never forget, and sat in the LGBT section on the floor and just took down every book I could find about transgender identity and started reading and knew. It's like, okay, I don't know what to do with this.
Mm-hmm. Were you in a relationship at the time?
Was I? I was at the time. But, you know, for me, again, this had always been very personal.
Yeah.
And deeply internal. And as far as I was concerned, there wasn't anything I could do to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was clear.
You were.
I was a lot clearer than I ever had been. I was still also very clear that I couldn't talk about it.
Well, that's what I wondered. What did that clarity do for you, or did it again? Because it can present challenges. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, no, now mm-hmm. I have to make this next, you know, set of announcements and changes.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't anticipating any sort of announcement. Mm. If anything, it I had an aha moment. Mm. I was able to breathe a little more deeply. And know that I could exist in the world being really clear about who I am. I hadn't thought through what it would look like to talk about that with other people and what that would mean for my life. If there were any changes I needed to make, I knew that at some point I might want to make some changes, but I wasn't ready for that at that time. Now, that took a few more years.
At this point, too, or at some point along the way, religion starts to become important to you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, while I was in law school, it was my second year, I woke up one morning and knew very clearly that I needed to find a church home. It was a little shocking for me, because the last time I'd been in church, honestly, I was probably somebody's wedding. And before that was probably my grandmother's church. And by then, I hadn't been to her church in years. So it was surprising to me. I told a few of my friends. They thought, you know, church really isn't typically the place where a queer person is going to feel at home. So rethink that, please, before you go someplace thinking that you can show up with your rainbow flags and just, like, have a good time. And so I put it aside. Like, it kept nagging at me. I'm like, this feels really real to me. I don't know why. But I'm going to hold off. And so I did. And I think it was my third year of law school, I ended up going to a benefit concert for Joan Nestle. And Lavender Light Gospel Choir was performing. They are, I believe, the second oldest LGBT gospel choir in the country. They're based in New York City. And I was floored by their performance. There were maybe 60 of them performing. Huge choir doing it, mostly music in the gospel tradition, some praise music. And I thought to myself, you know what? That's going to be my church. I'm going to graduate from law school because I just don't have time for anything in law school.
Yeah.
And I'm going to audition in September. I did, and it was my home for 5 years.
We'll find out where you went from that home when my conversation with Michael Slack, a minister and co-director of the Freedom Center for Social Justice, continues on The State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking with Michael Slack, a minister and a community organizer, co-directs the Freedom Center for Social Justice, and much, much more. And we'll talk about that in just a few moments. But we left you having been dazzled by the Lavender Light Gospel Choir. You had had spiritual stirrings and saw this choir and then found yourself a church. Tell us about that. Where did you go next?
You know, I auditioned, got in. Lavender Light's no joke. They are some remarkable singers. I'd encourage anybody to check them out. They have a couple of CDs, actually, over the last several years. But, you know, we sang and sang. We sang all over New York City, did some really incredible things. And one of the things that Lavender Light does every year is perform at an MLK service that is led by, at the time, like the three sort of main gay communities of faith in New York City. So Metropolitan Community Church of New York was one of those places, Congregation Beth Simchat Torah, which is the gay synagogue, and Unity Fellowship Church, which is a predominantly African-American Pentecostal church in Brooklyn. They would work together as congregations to put together this MLK service every January. And so, you know, Lavender Light sings. And so I showed up in January 2000 to perform. And typically what folks would do is they would leave after the performance. But I decided to stay and listen to the sermon and listen to and just be present for the service, and watched communion happen during that service and sobbed through the whole thing. I had seen communion happen before, you know, particularly in the Catholic tradition, I'd seen that. But MCC does communion a little differently. It offers the elements to folks and then offers a very individualized prayer. And there are usually four or five stations up at the altar where that happens. And I just watched. I didn't go up. I was probably too nervous and scared to go up. But I was literally sobbing through the whole thing.
What do you think it was? What was happening?
There was something about the connection in that. There was love in it. There was connection in it. There was deep care and compassion in it. And I had never experienced anything that just uplifted my spirit like that ever in my whole life. And that was a Thursday night. I'll never forget it. I walked out. I went home. I said, I'm going to come back here on Sunday. And I've been going to church ever since.
It seems to bring that full meaning or the fullness of your grandmother's understanding of the spark of the divine in all of us.
If
you love God as yourself and your neighbor and the earth.
Right. That's right.
And there it is.
And there it is. There it is. And so, you know, I started going to church. I got really active, really fast. I became a deacon and, you know, just lived. I lived a really good life. I was working as an attorney at the time. And I think it was at the ACLU. Yeah, I was at the Lesbian Gay Rights Project in New York City and just enjoying myself.
So you're an attorney.
Yep.
You're a singer. you're going to church, you got everything going, and now you've had these deeper revelations about who you are. Everything's going good, and then somebody knocks you over again because your connection to the church suggests to someone else that perhaps you have a deeper connection to the church and should pursue a different avenue. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. a lot was happening for me. which tends to be my life. Mm-hmm. It happens, you know, really, it's either really full or really kind of quiet. I was deeply involved and ultimately in my life as an attorney was really struggling. I wasn't happy. You grow up with some understandings about what it means to be successful, right? I was probably making more money than I'd ever made in my life. I was living in New York City. City that never sleeps. I was having a good time. But I was miserable and starting to have some panic attacks and just really freaking out about my life. And ultimately, right around that time, I wasn't talking about this to anybody. A good friend of mine who was an assistant minister at that church, I'll never forget, Kristen Klein Cecchettini was her name. She was sitting across the table from me at breakfast. She said, "So when are you going to own the fact that you want to be a minister in the world?" I knew that was true. I had inklings of that. Church was my favorite place to be. I had never told a soul that, right? Because at the time, I wasn't really about rocking the boat much. And I just looked at her. I was like, "I can't deal with you right now." I don't know where you got that from. Like, these people who keep seeing
me. Be gone, Satan.
Be gone. Like, these people who keep seeing me before I can sort of.
That's a pattern, right?
That's a
pattern.
Like, people keep knowing things about me that I have been too afraid to own for myself. So, you know, ultimately, I left law practice. Went into a deep depression because I didn't know what was happening in my life. And right around that time, the person who had worked at that church for a while quit suddenly, and they needed an office assistant and a personal assistant to the minister. So I applied. I got up, sent in my resume, and by February I had a job working in a church as an office assistant.
Where did it go from there?
From there, I got really clear, like, this is where I'm supposed to be. So I applied to seminary in 2004, Union Theological Seminary, and ultimately matriculated in September. Continued to serve that church in some ways through part of that seminary journey. As a staff counselor for Sylvia's Place, which is a shelter for queer kids that was housed in that church. Just did some amazing things. It felt really, really good. And it felt right, like I'm moving in the right direction.
What about the journey toward your gender identity? You had that moment of relief. What was next on that path?
What was next on that path ultimately was that I struggled internally for a long time and didn't really talk about what was going on for me until probably 2005. You know, it's like, okay, I'm in seminary. I am really growing in my understanding of God and my understanding of what it means to have a personal relationship with God. I was feeling really solid in my faith journey. And I thought to myself, you know what? I can't lie anymore about who I am. I just can't. And I trust my relationship with God. I trust the journey that I've been on and the one that I'm heading toward. And so if I lose everybody in this, because this is going
to
this is going to knock some people over in a big way. If I lose everybody, I've got God. And that means I'm going to be okay. And it was really that simple for me.
Yeah.
It was really that simple. Like, it just kind of clicked. Like, whoa, wait a second. I'm going to be fine.
But let's not reduce it, because you talk about the struggle. I mean, the fact when it was obvious, once you made the decision, it became simple. But getting to that
was rough.
Yeah.
It was real rough. You know, I suppressed a big part of who I was. And, you know, when you suppress who you are, it's hard to live well in the world right? Like I made all kinds of stupid mistakes. I wasn't in good relationship with a lot of people because I didn't know how to be in relationship with myself. Mm-hmm. Ultimately I knew that that would shift once I was able to just be clear.
And the God who made you said, why are you lying to me?
Why are you lying to me? I already know.
I sent you three boats in a helicopter. You know that
Come
joke?
On.
You know
oh,
that
yeah.
joke?
Oh, yeah.
yeah
oh,
that's
yeah.
that
oh,
joke.
Yeah.
So what did you do now? But you had this moment of reckoning. You would have to tell the people you were with.
I would
tell
have to tell
that.
The people. And so ultimately I ended a relationship that I'd been in for maybe 5 years because I knew that she was not interested in being in a relationship with a man.
Mm-hmm.
I ultimately left the church that I had been going to since 2000 for all kinds of reasons, but mostly it's like I need to enter into a new space, being the person I'm really called to be. I was seeing a therapist at the time who was really incredible and guided me through what I needed to get through. Changed my name legally, like changed my gender, like all kinds of things I did in New York. Excuse me. And, you know, wrote a big letter to my seminary community.
Mm-hmm.
My second year around Easter, I wrote a letter and talked to them, to the faculty, students, and staff. I just sent it to everybody and said, this is what resurrection looks like. This is what new life is. This is what being born again is all about. I am embarking on a new journey that is new to you, not new to me. And this is what I need from you. And I listed all the things. These are my pronouns. This is the restroom I would like to use in the building. You know, all these things. If you have questions, don't hesitate to sit down and talk to me. If you're going to struggle, that's okay. People are going to struggle. Just know that talking to me about your struggle isn't what's helpful to me right now. I need to be affirmed in who I am right now. Like this is, my whole life is about to shift. I'm about to tell my family. So I need lots of support. If you can't be supportive, that's okay. Just go be not supportive someplace else.
Okay.
Talk to your friends and family. Don't talk to me.
And how did they respond?
Overwhelming support. Union was... You know, they were really honest. Like, we've never had a trans student here as far as we know. Tell us what we need to do. And they did everything I asked. Everybody was just beautiful. I got, gosh, almost 200 responses
Wow.
to that email of love and support and tell us what to do. It was a really funny story. There are a couple of guys who I was really close to. And they're like, so you're a dude now, and I don't know, maybe do you need help like figuring out how to be a dude in the world? So they were like trying to give me like, okay, so like don't sit like that, like guys, don't sit like that. Like, you know, looking back, they were being so loving and beautiful to me. Like I don't ascribe particular behavior according to gender, but they were trying to be really loving to me. It was cute.
So what brought you to Durham?
Oh my goodness, Durham. My spouse and I did a southern tour. We love road trips, so we visited a bunch of cities in North and South Carolina. Fell in love with Durham. And knew, this was in 2013, knew that this was the place that we wanted to settle. We wanted to be closer to our families. My family was in Georgia. Her family was in Florida. And so this was a way for us to be closer. So we moved. We moved on faith. We didn't have jobs. We didn't have a place to live. We got here, and it was great.
You're currently a community minister for Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism. Tell us more about that.
Yes. That actually, there's an organizing collective that came together initially in Cleveland in 2015 during a movement for Black Lives convening. And these are Black folks who also happen to be Unitarian Universalists and thought, you know what, we feel a particular calling to provide resources and support for Black Unitarian Universalists who honestly don't often get that in their predominantly white congregations, right? And so this group of folks got together and have just been doing some amazing, amazing work. I wasn't a part of the collective at the time, but they had a convening last March Over 100 black UUs showed up from all over the country in New Orleans. And what they discovered was, which we could probably have guessed, but we actually heard from people say that their spiritual care was something that they didn't feel like they were getting. They weren't getting mm-hmm. spiritual care in these places, if they even chose to go to a congregation, right? There were a lot of black UUs who don't go to church at all. And so ultimately, they decided to bring me on as their community minister for worship and spiritual care. So that's been, you know, I've been volunteering in that role probably since March and came on staff very recently.
And it seems like you're trying to expand that mission, if I may, and building a new inclusive spiritual community in Durham.
Yeah, actually, you know, the two were initially unrelated. Yeah. You know, when Lelaine and I got here, Lelaine is my spouse, we knew that we wanted something different from spiritual community. We wanted a place that centered queer and trans people of color. We wanted a space that was not hierarchical, right? A space that really did church differently. and that was in many different spaces. So we've endeavored to build The Clearing, which is a new spiritual community that a number of folks have now been sort of engaged in and involved in having conversation about. So we've been talking about that a lot and starting to have some gatherings together. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of dovetailed really nicely into this work with Blue. You know, it's like, how do we create spaces?
What is the difference between, you know, sort of a kind of a political activism that calls for support, nurturing, acceptance, mm-hmm. And approval in a public space, and a spiritual connection? What does that bring to this conversation?
You know, I think we're all in the world, right, existing together, and there are ways in which many of us do not have access. We don't have what we need, right? We talk a lot about equality. But I like to think about equity, right? How is it that we can all get what we need? We're all not going to need the same things, right? And so it's a revolutionary act, I think, to engage in spiritual care, to really understand what your heart and your body and your mind and your spirit need, and to move toward getting us there, to getting people what they need. And so there's a definite connection, right, between sort of how we sort of show up in the world and what our hearts long for. And so we're trying to bring those things together, right?
And you're living in Durham now with your spouse and your child. What's that, 1-year-old, right?
Yeah,
just had a big party.
Last week.
Congratulations.
Thank
you. What's life like for you now?
Oh, my goodness. I don't sleep. I don't sleep. I'm lying. I always struggle with sleep. But my goodness, when you have a kid.
Mm-hmm. Ends when they're 35.
Yeah, thanks for that. Mm-hmm. But you know what? My life is so full. My kid is my whole heart. And they smile all the time. And they're just happy and joyful and wanting to learn all the things and loves us. And it's just stunning. It's stunning to be a parent in the world and to be a parent right now, you know, trying to grow up a little revolutionary, you know.
We could use a little more of that. So
yeah.
Keep up the good work.
Oh,
Michael
yeah.
Slack, co-director of the Freedom Center for Social Justice, also community minister for Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism. What a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more about Michael and his life and journey at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.